Spot Brain Telling, episode number one. I'd like to start out tonight by reading the latest Greasepot gem posted by Eagle. I did everything possible, gave more than 15% of my income, served and attended every function with a car breaking down all the time, giving up food and sleep to serve, and then got frowned at consistently. Believers I worked for failed to pay me, so I struggled other ways. Couldn't pay my car insurance and drove illegally to serve the Way International. I could only afford a junk car and got reamed for it. I had no family to support me, so no money. So cruel were people, especially Martindale, that I finally told them all to chuck it. My life took off after that. I decided to face midnight. I won. Again, thank you for listening this evening. We are going to be interviewing Krista, a.k.a. Chashu Farley. She lives in New England with her husband and two children and is enjoying life. Tonight, she's going to tell us a little bit about how the Way International affected her life. But before we do that, I'd like you to listen to a song by John Ruiz called Kitty Wampus. Following the song, we'll go directly into the interview. What were you thinking when you first got involved with the ministry? Obviously, it's real happy and things like that. How do you think it affected other aspects of your life that were already established, be it family, friends, and things like this? Now, all of a sudden, you're brought into this kind of new world.
Well, I was kind of an outsider in school. I wasn't one, you know, with the in crowd. I wasn't one of the beautiful people, so if you can believe it. So I got involved with them, and it was like instantly I had friends in the fellowship and stuff, but it was just these three wows for the most part. I remember the first twig I went to, where they had like no furniture, which I thought was the weirdest thing. I mean, I walked in their house, we sat on the floor for twig. You know, it wasn't even so much as a folding chair in the room, which it just seemed really strange, and it was in this really scuzzy apartment. So, you know, I mean, as far as like friends and family goes, I didn't really, I added some more friends to the list, I guess, but they didn't really impact me a lot in that way. I think what impacted me the most was as I learned more about the Bible, and even after I took PFAL and everything, I became a more positive person. It probably helped my self-esteem in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I was more sure of myself. And as a teenager, that's a big thing, you know, especially if you're not part of the in crowd. So it was like instant acceptance plus some knowledge. They always took you at face value. They never questioned anything you said or did or whatever. Everything was fine. And I even remember one of the wows was like kind of, he was kind of like coming on to me in a way I didn't want him to. I didn't really want anything from this guy as far as what, you know, he'd give me like a big wet sloppy kiss or a really long hug, that kind of thing. And I remember when I finally said something to him about it, I felt so bad. And he's like, oh, okay, no problem. Well, I just won't do that anymore. And I thought, what? You know, I thought they'd be really offended or something, but they weren't.
Hmm.
So it was just kind of like all of a sudden people were taking me at face value. My opinions and stuff kind of mattered, at least for a few minutes. So, for a teenager, that was just like, whoa, you know, I'm not being treated like a teenager. I'm not, you know, I'm being treated almost like an adult now. Of course, I was a senior in high school. But it was just that. I think going to the Rock of Ages, really, when I was that year, was probably what really nailed it for me is, wow, this is really something big, or so I thought. Little did I know.
Yes. Let me ask you this. You were a senior when you first were introduced, right?
Right.
What were your plans before the ministry got into your life?
I was going to go in the Air Force. I was all signed up. I'd signed up for the Air Force. I signed up at the beginning of my junior year of high school. So I was on the delayed enlistment program, but something happened the summer of my junior year, just before my senior year. I had a really bad fall and messed up one of my knees pretty good, and it's never been the same since. It's always kind of, I've had some problems with it, seen some specialists about it, that sort of thing. But the Air Force kind of didn't want me after that, not for what they had tagged me for. And then they went and they did a bait and switch on me with my, with what I was going to go in for my vocation. And I said no way to what they wanted me to end up doing, and I ended up dropping it. Hadn't really thought about going to college because I'm the youngest of 10 kids. You don't go to college when you're the youngest of 10 kids unless you go through the military or you have scholarships up the wazoo. I didn't have the scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
So what do? You know, so I figured, well, you know, when I figure out what I want to get in debt for doing, you know, then I'll go to school. So I'm just now getting around to that at 35. That's pretty sad.
I did not know you were the youngest of 10. That's
it's a collection of 10. It's kind of a Brady Bunch thing. It's like seven of his, two of hers, and then they got together, and I was the only child from that marriage with 10 kids.
Ah.
Why they thought they needed one more, I have no clue. I gave up after two.
Yeah, you know? I was going to say.
That's it. Everybody's done. Stick a fork in me, I'm done.
Okay, let's fast forward to when you were in, it was in California, was it Fresno? Or
yeah, it was Fresno. Well, half the year we were in Fresno, and then the other half we got moved to Fremont, and we were second wave wow, so we went out in October.
Right. Now, how did that impact your thinking and your direction in life?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. That's a tough one. Let's see. As far as I'm going to break that question down into two answers, basically.
Okay.
First, the thinking part. How did it impact my thinking? In a way, it was kind of like scared to death, but too naive to back out of it. I don't know if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
And plus, I was with, maybe it's more of an emotional, not really thinking, but, you know, when you're that age, those are one and the same. You don't really think about stuff. You act on emotions a lot. You're more impulsive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for I had a wow sister especially who was real charismatic. She could talk anybody into almost anything. She had the gift of gab big time. And she could talk me into stay. I'd be ready to leave one minute, and she could talk me into staying the next. You know, she was just that kind of gal. And so I just, you know, for the thinking part of it, it was like, I don't know, I guess I grew up in a lot of ways then. I learned to be more responsible for my decisions and stuff after a while. You know, after you get kicked in the head enough. But as far as how it impacted my life, that's really hard to answer, because it was like, I mean, I left before the year finished. So I kind of took a bad kick there, if you will. It was humbling. I thought I was going to leave the ministry altogether at one point, and I didn't. It was a real low time during that time, and I kind of recovered from that, and I guess I felt like I had to redeem myself. So when I went to the Rock of Ages that year, that would have been 1990, I decided I wanted to work on limb staff somehow, interviewed with a couple of limb coordinators, and ended up going to work for the Limb of Alabama, and that's how I ended up moving down there. So it was just kind of an interesting way it worked out. I felt like I needed to redeem myself, and I also was buying into the teaching at the time of separating yourself from your family and your old man ways and all that stuff. So, you know, it's like, well, gee, I got to get out of Maine again. You know, I've been back in Maine, and I got to get out of it. And it's not that I really had anything that bad to go back to. I wasn't a kid who did drugs or drank a lot, or I partied, but probably no worse than anyone else my age, and probably a heck of a lot less than my peers, really, come to think of it. And, you know, I was really a pretty responsible kid. So, you know, it was just, I saw my family as being a problem because the way I said it was. You know, I separated myself from my family at that time and went down to Alabama, and that's when I met my first husband. Straight downhill, or history, or whatever you want to call it.
Something you mentioned a couple of times here is redeeming yourself. Was that an inner thing, or was that something that was from the ministry?
Gosh, it's one of those things that if I tried to explain it to somebody who is an outsider, it would be impossible. If you've been in, boy, you know. It's the way you're spoken to by leadership. It's the way you're looked at during teachings. It's the way they work on your mind in some ways. And I'm not saying they do mind control, mind you, but it's what you buy into, your free will choice, how much of the Kool-Aid you're willing to swallow, as to whether or not you're worthy to be in their presence for teachings and fellowship and functions and things like that. You know, they like to drop the term being in and out of fellowship, you know, and stuff like that. So when I say redeem yourself, you know, it's having favor in the eyes of leadership. What it comes right down to, you know, putting it in layman's terms, is pleasing men. You know, it's what you're doing to please leadership. And some of those guys could be real boogers. I mean, wouldn't matter what you drove, what you had for a job, how you dressed. It was never good enough. You know, you were never up to par. You were never skinny enough. You were never cute enough. You were never, you know, whatever. And it just didn't matter. So you just try to work harder to be that. So you stopped thinking about what you were doing to please God. You know, my leaving the WOW field was the honest thing to do. We weren't doing what we were sent out there to do. I still feel to this day it was the honest thing to do. We're not witnessing. We're told not to witness. Why the hell are we here? To pay bills? I can do that at home. Thank you. Yeah. So it's kind of, so I left. And I got, you know, I bought a lot of crap for it. But, you know, would it be more honest for me to finish the year and not do that and get the damn WOW pin? No. You know, so, you know, even to this day, because I had a WOW year that we went out there and we did what we were supposed to do, and we finished, and I'm proud of that, you know. So I've had two WOW years, one that was the poster child for what it is not, and one that was closer to the poster child for what it should have been. So, but back to the redeeming yourself, yeah, unless you've been there, it's hard to explain, but, you know, you've probably been there, you probably know.
I have been there. Yes.
So, yeah. What? How do I get back in fellowship with the household, or you know, whatever? Oh, choke now. Think about it.
Mm-hmm. You got married when you were in Alabama, right?
Yep. Now, I got married. It was 3 months after my 21st birthday.
Wow.
That, huh?
That's okay. Young I did something. What was I? I was 23, I think. But.
Yeah, it's young and stupid.
Yeah. How did you feel about that relationship? Sometimes when you're doing things like redeeming yourself and that, you're in a mode of kind of losing yourself and becoming this thing that others want you to be.
Yeah.
How did that play into your relationship with your first husband?
It's interesting because probably the person he met and fell in love with was more true to themselves than the person he divorced
mm-hmm.
or divorced him later on. Because I was younger, I was probably a little more headstrong, a little more stubborn, spoke up more often, stepped in things more often, that sort of thing. So, I still listen to a lot of secular music, for example. I didn't dress like the way Stepford Wives,
Thank God for that.
Oh, God. Jeez. I refuse to wear Alfred Dunner label at 20, you know. So if you're a woman, that would mean something to you, Mike. But, it's like there's just some things that I just wasn't willing to do. And I'd get called out on the carpet for stuff. They'd try to refine me and stuff like that. And eventually I became a little more refined in their terms. I don't think I really did a lot then to please other people. It's like, we met each other, there was an attraction, nobody set us up, that sort of thing. He had actually left the ministry and just come back in. He left, he was out in California. We'd never crossed paths in California, but he was out there the same time I was. But he had already left. He was actually an assistant coordinator for a big shot way leader out there. I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But the guy that he worked for and stuff, he said, I'm going to go back to Alabama and see what's going on there and then decide if I'm going to stay with the ministry or with the offshoot and go from there. And he came back, just at the time that they were running the Galatian tapes, the leadership tapes. So he'd just gotten back involved with it, and I was a limb secretary. And, we kind of eyeballed each other, and it was kind of love at first sight, if you will. No intellect involved whatsoever. So a year later, we got married, and we went through the marriage counseling and all that stuff. And I remember going through that. I got reproved the whole time through that solidly. I just got screamed at. I just sat down for the one-hour session, and my limb coordinator just started yelling. So it was like, yeah, all right, whatever. So, but we just, we just wanted to get married. We just wanted to be together. So we went through with it. So. I can't really say I changed who I was to marry him. I changed who I was afterwards because of the leadership we had, or because we wanted to go wow, or because we wanted to go in the core, or whatever. I'd try to adapt to that, and somehow I didn't always totally 100% fit in, which was probably somewhat healthy, but. There's still a good bit of myself that I wasn't true to anymore after a while, just because it was kind of to become a company man,
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that was at, I guess.
Now, what year did you get divorced?
I got divorced in 1998.
And then you went back to Maine at that point, didn't you?
I went back to Maine before the divorce. We got kicked off. We were on staff. We got kicked off staff. We got sent to a city in Tennessee that we had never been to in our lives, so that we could be closer to our old leadership who'd gotten moved.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure. And we were given 1 week to find housing and jobs, and we did that. But he never found a job, and that's when he got marked in a void. And that's when I said sayonara.
Mm-hmm.
And I just reached the end of my rope with everything. I mean, we lost our jobs. We showed up. We didn't have a car. We had nothing. What we had would fit in a you know, would probably fit in a small SUV for what we owned. Not that we had an SUV to pack it in. that would have been a fantasy at that point. So, you know, it was just, I was just tired of life just being one big loss after another of everything. You know, here I was, what was I, 27, 26, 27, and I had absolutely nothing to show for it, not even a Wowmobile. So, you know, I just said, to heck with it. And I went to Maine from there. And in Maine, you have to wait a year before you can file for divorce if you weren't married in that state. So I waited a year and filed for the divorce and everything, and it was an uncontested. He didn't even have a clue he was divorced. So.
Well, now, you were fed up. Were you fed up with the marriage or with the ministry, or was it a combination of the two?
It was with the marriage. Actually, the ministry I was going to stay true to, because they were like, oh, leave, you know, go back, you know, if your family can take you in. All of a sudden, my family was good for something, you know. If your family can take you in and you can get a job and all that stuff, and maybe you can buy a car or whatever, or your mom will buy you a car or something like that. My mom was widowed, so they figured she had money because she was widowed. Wrong. They figured if I packed it up and went back there, you know, then I could be a productive little wafer and stuff and stay in. And I planned to, you know, and I went back up there and everything, and I stayed involved. It was tough when I first went up there, man. It was the toughest thing, making that first phone call to a twig coordinator and saying, hey, I've moved into your area, and you know, I'm this loser that's going through a divorce. You know? Basically what I felt like I was doing. I mean, it couldn't suck enough. It was just absolute worst thing. And I remember just bawling on the phone as I'm talking to this guy. I never met him before in my life. I just felt like such an idiot. And it was tough going back home and stuff and getting back involved. But the people in New Hampshire, I had to twig in New Hampshire because I was so far in southern Maine. The nearest twig to me, I think, was like in Portland or something like that, which was over an hour away. I was almost in New Hampshire anyway, so I started twigging in New Hampshire. The people there were just good people. They just were really nice. It was just a nice, tight-knit bunch of Joes. You know, they'd been together forever, you know. And what's interesting is nowadays I've kept tabs with some of them, and none of them are left in the area anymore. They've either left the ministry, and I think only one's left, and I think they go to southern New Hampshire to go to fellowship. So it's pretty sad. And these are people who'd been around for, you know, 20, 30 years or whatever. You know, they got involved in the 70s, most of them. So, you know, coming back home, it was a different thing. But it was a whole different ball of wax when I went to Massachusetts, because I was not well received there at all. Not after a while. I was at first, but then there was a change in leadership. And that's when I got fed up with the ministry. So the marriage went first. And then it's like I went through one divorce, and then I had to go through a second one. You know, probably sometimes now I wish I'd ditched the whole thing at once, but I guess I had to open my eyes to one thing before I could see the other.
Mm-hmm. What was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back for you when you were in Massachusetts?
I was getting called on the carpet for the damnedest, stupidest things. It was just, this just really irked me to no end. I had this roommate for a while who was real, she was way core and stuff, and she was nice lady, total company man, though. When there was a change in leadership, I found she would basically sell her soul for leadership to accept her, is how I felt. And I just couldn't believe the way she basically sold me down the river, is the way somebody put it in my fellowship. I had several people in our fellowship. I was her assistant coordinator, who just couldn't believe what happened. For instance, one example, my back went out once, and I don't have a lot of health problems, but I had a lower back problem for whatever reason, I couldn't tie my shoes. I could hardly get dressed in the morning. I was still trying to make it to work, so I didn't make my bed. Well, next thing I know, my region coordinator is reproving me face to face for it. Is this necessary? You know, why don't you just ask me, Krista, why haven't you made your bed? Is something wrong? You know, no, they would rather just, you know, I started getting a ration of, and when I tried to explain what was going on, I was told, you know, you're getting defensive. Well, yeah, I'm defending myself because you're wrong. You didn't ask me my side of the story. And the irony of it is the same person. I had done stuff for her. She had a back problem like 6 months ago, and I had, like, made her bed for her and lifted up her, you know, carried her laundry for her, and brought in her groceries, crap like that. You know, I had waited on her, basically, and just did it as a friend. I mean, I thought she was a girlfriend type thing, and just helped her out. You know, she's my roommate. She was my fellowship coordinator, and, you know, I thought she was my friend, you know, until she did crap like that. And, you know, and I went to, about a month later, I went to my high school reunion, and I had started planning, like, 2 months ahead of time to go. Got the invitation, talked to her about it, said, you know, I want to go to this and stuff, and what do you think? And she said, yeah, if you're into it, go and stuff. And I made the arrangements, and I made my reservations and everything. Now, my high school, from where I was at in Massachusetts, my high school in Maine was only an hour and a half from where I was living in Massachusetts, 90 minutes up Route 95. Well, the day before I was supposed to leave for this, she pulls me aside and says, how come you're going alone? I'm concerned about it. You're supposed to be two by two. And I said, well, who am I supposed to take for a date, okay? And she named off a couple people, and most the single guys there were all, like, in their 50s and stuff. I'm like, no way. And she goes, well, what about taking a girl with you? Okay, I'm going to go and look like a dyke. That's great. Because you have a girl show up at her reunion with another girl, people are just going to automatically assume that that's your significant other and forget it. And I'm just like, but that's not me. I don't want people, wouldn't that make them think evil? And I said, besides, I wasn't planning on going with anybody. I've made reservations. I'm staying overnight because the thing's probably going to go to midnight. I don't want to drive back home after that, you know. And so I went up. I had an absolute ball. I had the best time of my life. I went by myself, didn't take anybody with me, stayed overnight. Actually, I pulled an all-nighter with a bunch of old friends and stuff. We just had a great time. I did nothing that I wouldn't be ashamed for the Pope to see or my mother or my cat, you name it. I don't care. You know, we just had a good time telling stories and talking and all that until the wee hours of the morning. And then we went out for breakfast, and I went back home. I knew I was in a boatload of trouble. Sure enough, about a week later, I got called on the carpet by the region coordinator. You know, and again, it's like, is this necessary? And I finally just said to them, you know, if this is the biggest problem you've got going on, then things are pretty tame. You know, you got a 30-something go into, or an almost 30-something go into a reunion, high school reunion in Maine. You know, I'm pretty harmless. You know, I'm about as I'm about as laid back as they come. I'm just like, you know, break. And they just jumped my shit for it. I jumped through all the hoops to make sure everything was kosher with them, but 24 hours before I was supposed to go, all of a sudden nothing was kosher about it anymore. So I was just sick of the head games. And finally one day I was tired of dreading going to TWIG. I was tired of passing in the schedules and tired of getting called out on the carpet for petty stuff like that. So I called up my TWIG coordinator one day. I had my Bible in my car, my Sing Along the Way songbook, my notebook, all the whole nine yards, my schedule. And I said, you know what, I'm not coming today, and I'm probably not coming back again. He asked why, and I explained to him exactly how I felt in rather colorful terms at the time. And he said, I don't blame you. They haven't treated you well, and I agree. And I was like, what? Say that again. So he says it's been totally unnecessary, some of the stuff they've gotten on your case about. And he agreed. He actually agreed, and he was sympathetic. But, of course, he threw in the hook, you know, but for me to let you come back, we have to talk to the region coordinator. No thanks. You know, that's quite okay. That conversation won't be happening. So, because I'm done. I'm finished. Stick a fork in it, you know. And that was January of 2000. And something else that added to it, too, I'll be honest. The Y2K prep and all the fear motivation and all that went with that. And then I so much as didn't have a light bulb go out that night.
Right.
So that was just like, okay, yeah, they're prophets. They know what they're talking about. What a crock of crap. I mean, people spent tons of money. I think I bought a gallon of water and like four extra cans of food, to be honest with you.
Right.
Maybe a little extra toilet paper. You know, it was like, who cares? You know, I knew stuff wouldn't happen like that. And I figured when Russia went through it with no problems, America would be fine. third world countries do just fine.
Yeah, I remember watching it that night, and, you know, they were going, like, time zone by time zone, you know, and it was like, this one's okay, this one's okay, and I did the same thing. I said, you know, if Russia can make it through, I think the U.S. will do it, you know, and I had even taken computers and did a simulation, you know, put it on, you know, January 31st, 1999, and then ran it through to see what would happen, and it was like, looks okay to me, you know, so.
Yeah, and still walking like a duck and quacking like a duck.
Yeah, I had to leave, I had to leave a New Year's Eve party that night, and it had nothing to do with the ministry, to go to my company and make sure that the Y2K thing went all right, you know, so.
Yeah, and I mean, where I was working at the time, I mean, they weren't even concerned about it one iota. They were like, so what? And I was right in the process of changing jobs at the time, and the company that I was going to work for was owned by a Russian and a guy from and a German. You know, they're both imports. And they were just like, they're both engineers and very, very intelligent men. And they just couldn't believe. They're like, why is everybody going nuts? They're like, this is like the way we would prepare for when we thought there was going to be bombings, you know, in our country. They're like, couldn't believe what the Americans were going through. They were like, they're laughing. They thought it was hysterical. And I didn't take it seriously because I knew what a technophobe Martindale was. You know, I knew he was an idiot about stuff like that. I mean, you just listened to him talk, you knew he was an idiot about it. So I was just like, this is going to be a non-event. It was such a big non-event. So that was something else, too, that just kind of added to it. It was a bunch of little straws at once, you know, that built up over time. And I just said, this is enough. This is going nowhere fast.
Looking back on the whole experience, how do you feel that it impacted your life one way or another? That section of time in your life?
It's lost. That's how I feel now, and I'm kind of bitter about it in some ways, I'll be honest, even to this day. Not unhealthy bitter, just, okay, let me give you an example. Like, my husband and I will talk sometimes about music and things like that, and I can't tell you anything about music, movies, trends, things like that in the 90s. I know nothing about it. It's like he's talking another language. I feel like I was in a different country or on another planet even sometimes. And he'll go like, oh yeah, that's right. You're in the cult then, weren't you? We'll quit. So, but he's right though. It was like being underground. You know, a friend of mine put it that it was, you know, somebody told her it was like she was in the witness protection program or something, you know, because she was just so clueless about stuff that was going on in the real world, you know. And even though I was, you know, it's not like I was on staff forever or anything like that. It's just, who had time to pay any attention to news stories and you know, certain trends and things like that? You know, it was like the whole OJ trials. I knew they were going on, but I didn't pay any attention to them. So when there would be jokes and things like that about it, I had no idea what anybody was talking about. You know, who doesn't remember the OJ trials? You know, who wasn't involved with the way then? That's all that was on the media, I'm sure. You know, so it's kind of wild. So it's like in some ways I'm kind of resentful because it's like 10 years that could have been really productive were just gone. I mean, I'm glad I waited to have my children, you know, till I was with the right man to be their dad and everything. But I keep thinking, you know, here I am 35 and I'm chasing around a one-year-old and I'm going, I wish I'd been doing this when I was 25 because it sure gets tiresome, you know, that kind of thing. So it's just those things that I could have gotten a start on a lot earlier that I'm just now starting on. You know, another example is I just had braces a couple of years ago. I could have done that eons ago. Same with going back to school. You know, it's like I'm having my 20s late. You know, 10 years too late on my 20s. So that's how I feel about how it's impacted my life. In some ways, it's positive. I mean, I'm glad I took PFAL. I honestly am. I wish I'd stopped there.
mm-hmm.
and just called it quits then. I wish I'd stayed true to myself enough to do it there. But I wasn't, you know, I didn't. And that's, I have no one to blame but myself. I don't blame them. I take full ownership for the decisions that I made. But I just wish that I had, looking back now, for what it's worth, which is nothing, is that I wish that I wish I'd bowed out a heck of a lot earlier and enjoyed my 20s.
Yeah.
You know, I look on the new Way website now, you know, the waypeeps.com or whatever the heck it's called now, the one, the groups on MySpace.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's all these really young kids, and they remind me so much of myself at that age, and I just want to go, do you have any clue what you're doing? Of course, they'd come back with some canned answer, right. Like, you know, renew your mind, and, you know, you're not standing on the present truth and crap like that, you know. But that's what I would have done at that age, too, you know. So it's painful to see it, though, because it's just you're pissing away some of the best years of your life right there. You could be having a blast. You're listening to the same teachings I was listening to 10 years ago, the exact same teachings. Yuck.
So how does the future look?
Let me tell you what happened. I left in January of 2000, right? In February, I met another grease spotter. In August, we got married. By November, we were pregnant with our first child. You know, June of the following year, 2001, we bought a house. July, our first child was born due to the closing on the house. He was 6 weeks early, but hey, he was fine, though. He still came out roaring, still roaring to this day. You know, so I went from zero to the American dream in no time, you know. I mean, it amazes me sometimes, because it's like when we first moved in the house, I was like, I never thought I would own anything like this in my life, you know. And also the other thing, when I first met my husband, he just before we were even engaged, we bought a car together. I'd never bought a car like that before, not one that you made payments on, which still kind of irritates me to this day. I hate making car payments. I'm like, I used to drive broken down pieces of crap for what we used for down payments, you know? And they ran just fine. I knew what to expect. They all blew oil and leaked gas and everything else, but hey, they were paid for. Yeah, so it's just kind of wild, because it's just so different. But I went from zero to the American dream so fast that I almost couldn't handle it in some ways. I didn't know what to do with it, you know. It was so foreign. It was so much at once. And we just had our second child. So the future, I mean, the future looks like it's going to involve, for me, going back to school pretty soon, probably this summer I'm going to start. And, you know, I've got my own business at home. I work outside the home a little bit part time. You know, we're busy raising our two kids and living life and you know, talking about retirement, which is something I've never talked about in my life or thought about. So it's just so different. It's just so different. I can't begin to tell you. You know, it's probably every Tuesday, Thursday night, and Sunday morning, I go, thank God, not wasting my time sitting on a couch, waiting for some windbag to finish their teaching, so I can go home and, you know, write them a thank you note as to how wonderful it was, or some crap all like that. So, yeah, it's night and day. And actually, we go to church. My husband, we belong to a Greek Orthodox church, just mainly because my husband's family helped found the church. So it's kind of significant for the family. Mm-hmm. We don't really subscribe to a lot of the beliefs, but we also go to a community church that I go to mainly for social reasons. You know, their teachings are not, I can find holes in their teachings all the time if I want to put on Way Brain, but you know, that's a lot of work. So I go, I listen to the teachings, I filter through what's good for me and what I can get out of it and stuff, but mostly I go to get out and to be a part of the community. And that's something I never had before, was that sense of community. So, and it's something I enjoy, so it's something that we're getting more involved in all the time. So the future actually is, you know, it's bright. It's got a lot of work to it. Raising kids is hard work and stuff, but you know, I think if I'd stayed on the track I was on before, I wouldn't have this family I've got. I wouldn't have the house I've got and the possibility of going back to school. I would be working a part-time job, going to fellowship 3 nights or 3 days a week and you know, have all my time eaten up with other crazy-ass meetings and witnessing outings and stuff like that that didn't amount to a hill of beans and was going nowhere anyways.
Yeah, when I left, there was a song out, which is probably apropos here, is "The Future's So Bright, I Gotta Wear Shades."
Wear Shades, yes, yes. Yeah, I remember that. Actually, I've got that album. I know exactly.
You've got a Timbuk 3 album?
Timbuk 3 album. I have got the vinyl with that
You're
on it.
You're kidding me. Wow.
One hit wonder.
Yes, they were. But what a hit it was. It was a great song.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's so, that's so 80s, though. Oh, my gosh.
Well, yeah. Well, do you have any parting words you'd like to give to the audience?
Oh, gosh. Nothing terribly profound. I mean, it's kind of one of those things that it's sometimes it's so hard to explain it. I try to think of how I would explain it to somebody who'd never been there, like somebody who's maybe listening to this because they've got a family member getting involved or they're thinking about getting involved. And, you know, I don't want to totally alienate them from it or make them think it's a 100% evil thing because it's not. There's still pockets of good people who are involved and stuff, people who are involved for the right reasons and who are still actually, you know, who are still getting stuff out of it. It works for them, you know. It's, you know, it'd be no different than, like, my going to the community church. It works for me right now. But overall, but when you sign on the dotted line, man, and commit yourself to it, then it becomes a totally different animal. You know, it just changes so much. And I just can't understand how anybody can just sell out to it anymore for what it is. When I got involved, it was a different ministry. There was still a research department, things like that. That's been long gone. I think actually the year I got involved was probably the last year of the research department. Because there has been nothing new under the sun since then at all.
Yes.
With them. So it's just, I'd hate to see other people, especially young people, do what I did. You know, at least I got out while I was still young enough to get my piece of the American dream. And for that, I'm thankful because I've got some friends who didn't do so well.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
They're just now getting in and they're just now getting out and they're a heck of a lot older. They can't really start over again. They've got to just kind of make the most of what they've got. So, and that's, for them, it's a different, you know, it's a much different situation. You know, I think about how I'm upset about losing my 20s. I know people have lost their 20s, 30s, and 40s, you know, for it.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. And thanks for all you do. I know you work your fanny off.
Yeah, I still got too much of a fanny. I need to do some more work.
Get over here.
Bring another episode in the next few weeks, and this will be an ongoing series. We will be doing interviews and some other fun stuff too. We'll see you soon at Greasepot.